Okay, well, let's turn to Leviticus chapter 23 and the section on the Feast of Tabernacles is the last part of that chapter, so it starts in verse 33 and goes down to verse 44. So whoever's feeling energetic can read that passage. It's about 10 or 11 verses. So Leviticus chapter 23, we'll read from verse 33 to the end of the chapter.
And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, The 15th day of the seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days unto the Lord. On the first day shall be an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein. 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. On the eighth day shall be an holy convocation unto you, and you shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. It is a solemn assembly, and ye shall do no servile work therein. These are the feasts of the Lord, which ye shall proclaim to be holy convocations, to offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord, a burnt offering, and a meat offering, a sacrifice, and drink offerings, everything upon his day. Beside the Sabbaths of the Lord, and beside your gifts, and beside all your vows, and beside all your freewill offerings, which ye give unto the Lord. Also in the 15th day of the seventh month, when ye have gathered in the fruit of the land, ye shall keep a feast unto the Lord 7 days. On the first day shall be a Sabbath, and on the eighth day shall be a Sabbath. And ye shall take you on the first day the boughs of goodly trees, branches of palm trees, and the boughs of thick trees, and willows of the brook, and ye shall rejoice before the Lord your God 7 days. And ye shall keep it a feast unto the Lord 7 days in the year. It shall be a statute forever in your generations. Ye shall celebrate it in the seventh month. Ye shall dwell in booths 7 days. All that are Israelites born shall dwell in booths. That your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God, and Moses declared unto the children of Israel the feast of the Lord.
Okay, so this feast wraps up the cycle of the annual feast for Israel. It's a climax in terms of Israel's fellowship with the Lord, basically, which is what it ultimately will be typified when the Lord returns and dwells with his people, in the millennium. One thing to understand, again, that these feasts are on specific days, right? This one happens to be on the 15th day of the seventh month. Okay, the seventh month has the full feasts, right, as we've seen. The Rosh Hashanah was the first day. 10th day was Yom Kippur, the atonement. And now we come to Tabernacles, okay? Now, one of the main features of this feast was the idea that they were to dwell in booths for 7 days, right? It was kind of to commemorate, basically, their temporary dwelling places all throughout their wilderness journey from Egypt to the Promised Land, right? God would have them remember that. And the word for booths, in the Hebrew, it's the word Sukkot. And, of course, the Jews refer to it as the Feast of Sukkot. And basically, when we talk about the booth, and particularly the wilderness journey, and what actually transpired there, God commissioned Moses to basically to build him, the singular word of Sukkot being sukkah, a booth. He commanded for him to, for Moses and the children of Israel to build his booth, literally his dwelling place or his sanctuary with them in the desert. Okay. And the word tabernacle, which is basically what they were to construct, the word Hebrew word mishkan, basically the idea of this sanctuary where the Lord would be dwelling in their midst. One very interesting thing about the construction of this tabernacle, if you turn over to Exodus chapter 25, verses 8 and 9, it was to be built according to very specific plans. Take a look at verses 8 and 9 in Exodus chapter 25. Somebody go ahead and read that.
And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them, according to all that I show thee, after the pattern of the tabernacle, on the pattern of all the instruments thereof, even so shall ye make it.
You see, It was God's desire to always dwell among his people, right? And so in accord with that, he tells them to build them this tabernacle, literally the sanctuary. And notice that Moses was actually shown what to construct, right? He says, see that you make it after the pattern that I showed you. This is really, if you look into the Epistle to the Hebrews, chapter 8, verse 5. Somebody read that. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5. Keep your hand in Exodus 25, by the way. Hebrews 8, verse 5. Somebody want to read that? Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5. See, he was actually shown something. Moses actually saw the real tabernacle. Okay? This is what these verses seem to be indicating. If you go back to Exodus chapter 25, look at verse 40. What does it say? Last verse of that chapter. You see, I mean, the Lord is trying to emphasize the point that Moses actually saw what it is that had to be constructed, right? And seeing it, the Lord described it to him, and he actually visually saw it, okay, and actually then was able to make a copy, which then they carried on the earth, right? So, those were very interesting verses to see that. Now, as far as this tabernacle was concerned, and particularly the fact that it was to be a dwelling place, all through the wilderness journey, every Israelite, okay, had the comfort of knowing that the Lord's presence was right there. They saw him in the cloud by day and in the pillar of fire by night, right? Come over to Exodus chapter 13, verses 20 to 22. Take a look at that. Exodus chapter 13, verses 20 through 22. Somebody want to read that? Exodus 13, verses 20 to 22.
And they took their journey from Succoth and encamped in Etham in the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of a cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, to go by day and night. He took not away the pillar of the cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people.
Interesting how the word Succoth and the fact that, because that's where they journeyed from, right? And the fact that his presence was right there. This is what Succoth is all about. God dwelling with his people. Okay? And come over to Exodus chapter 40, verses 34 to 38. And, you know, they could actually see the glory of that presence all throughout their wilderness journey. Exodus chapter 40, verses 34 to 38. Somebody go ahead and read that. Exodus chapter 40, verses 34 through 38. I mean, that was an impressive sight, wasn't it? I mean, every Israelite could have that confidence. They knew, they actually saw their God in their midst and his presence guiding them all the way. And basically, as long as the cloud was resting on the tabernacle, they rested. When it was taken off, they moved on. And so that was the experience. And in that sense, the wilderness journey and his constantly, and his constant abode with them is pretty much a foretaste of what the millennium will actually be like. All right. Now, there's some other names by which the Feast of Tabernacles is known. It's also sometimes called by the Jews the Feast of the Dedication. And the reason for that is that when they built Solomon built the temple, that temple was actually dedicated during the Feast of Tabernacles. Come over to 2 Chronicles chapter 7, and let's read verses 7 through 11. 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verses 7 through 11. So we want to read that. Know that this was the Feast of Tabernacles when the dedication was, is the key is in verse 10, because he sent them away on what day of the month? The 23rd day of the 7th month. It was the 8th day after the 7-day feast, takes you back to the 15th day. And that's when the temple was dedicated. And if you keep in mind, again, you remember we looked about, and we're going to come to this in a minute, and when we saw the section of description of the feast in Leviticus 23, it says specifically that they were to rejoice before the Lord during this time, right? And so it's very fitting, therefore, that the dedication would be at a time of joy when they would be rejoicing before the Lord. When they're speaking about, this is why the Jews also call it the season of our joy, okay? Not only because they were commanded to rejoice there, but when you consider the timing of the feast, when does it occur? Well, it basically occurs after that 40-day period of Teshuvah, which was the season of repentance, right? Remember that 45 days, the 6-month 30 days, and then the first 10 days of the 7th month was a period of Teshuvah, season of repentance, a climax with the Day of Atonement on the 10th day, right? So that was the most solemn period in of Israel's calendar. And after sins have been dealt with and the Day of Covering has taken place, then the people could again, what? Rejoice in renewed fellowship with the Lord, right? So that's when another emphasis on the fact of why it was such a time of rejoicing. And it really typifies what ultimately will be Israel's experience again at the second coming. Take a look at Isaiah chapter 4, verses 3 to 6. Isaiah chapter 4, verses 3 through 6. What does that say? Isaiah chapter 4, verses 3 through 6. Anybody got it?
And it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem shall be called holy, even every one that is written among the living in Jerusalem. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. And the Lord will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud that is smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night, for upon all glory shall be a defense. And there shall be a tabernacle for a shadow in the daytime from the heat, and for a place of refuge, and for a covert from storm and from rain.
This kind of brings us full circle, doesn't it? Talks about the cloud by day, the fire by night again. The beginning of that being that wilderness journey back there from Egypt to the promised land. And now we see it at the Lord's return, right? That there will be a permanent, restored fellowship after the filth of sin has been, the filter of idolatry has been removed from the nation once and for all, right? And of course, like in the new covenant on the Feast of Atonement is instituted, right? And then comes that renewed and permanent fellowship where Israel will forever basically rejoice with the Lord in their in His presence in their midst. Okay? One other title that the feast is also known by, it's actually called the Feast of the Ingathering. Come over to Exodus chapter 23, verse 16. Exodus 23, verse 16. What do we read there? Exodus chapter 23, verse 16.
And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering at the end of the year, when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field.
Okay, see that. So again, you know, all these feasts also relate to Israel's agrarian type of cycle of the year, right? And basically, the Feast of Tabernacles, which is the final fall festival, right? That's when the full harvest comes in, right? Everything from the field, the orchard, the vineyard, it all gets gathered in. So it's the Feast of the Ingathering. And of course, again, what is that a type of? It's a type of the final harvest of the redeemed. Okay, come over to Matthew chapter 13. That's a parable on all. There's seven parables in that chapter in Matthew 13. They all deal with the kingdom of heaven or the millennium. They're called seven secrets there. And take a look at, you know, talking about the harvest here. Matthew chapter 13. Somebody read verses 23 through 30. Huh? Matthew 23, Matthew 13, rather, verses 23 through 30. What does it say?
And he that receives seed into the good ground is he that heareth the word and understands it, which also beareth fruit and bringeth forth some and a hundredfold and some six and some 30, 60 and some 30. Another parable put he forth unto him, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man
who sowed good seed in the field. Wait a second. I might have gotten the wrong verse on that one. Did I? Let me see. I think I messed up here. Let me take a look. Okay. No, go ahead. I'm sorry. It's a senior moment. I'm sorry. Okay, continue reading.
I'll start with 22.
All right.
Another parable he put forth unto him, saying, the kingdom of heaven is the likened unto a man which sowed seed in the field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat and went his way. But when the blaze was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared also the tares. So the servants of the household came and said unto him, sir, didst not thou sow good seed in thy field from whence? Then as a tear, he said unto them, mammon has done this. The servant said unto him, wilt thou then that we go and gather them up? But he said, nay, let while we gather the tares, you root up the good wheat. Let's both grow together until the harvest, and then the time of the harvest, I will say unto reapers, gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles, and turn them
Okay, and this is basically a parable describing the end of the kingdom age, okay? The Lord leaves for a season and all of a sudden there's these tares that go, and of course Satan's loosed, right? After that, and sows some of his own stuff. And so then the Lord says, let everything go till the end of the age. Now look at the interpretation of this parable in verses 36 to 43. Somebody got to read that. 36 to 43. Same chapter.
Then Jesus sent the multitude away and went into the house. And his disciples came to him, saying, explain to us the parable of the tares of the field. He answered and said to them, he who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. The good seeds are the sons of the kingdom, but the tares are the sons of the wicked one. The enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. Therefore, as the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of this age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and those who practice lawlessness, and will cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears to hear, let him hear.
Now, something that's very interesting when you read the parables here, you know, like a lot of people will say, well, the parables are meant to communicate or explain truth, right? Because if you were to hear somebody speaking of the roadside saying, a sower went forth to sow, this, you know, this seed, that seed, and, you know, and the tares and whatnot, would that mean anything to you? It would just be a story, wouldn't it? It wouldn't mean anything at all, right? Now, if somebody said, like it says in the, like if it says here, he says, well, he sends the multitude away, doesn't he? Do they get the interpretation? No, it's only meant for his disciples, right? He gets the, he tells them, okay, well, look, you know, he that sows the good seed is the Son of Man, the fields, the world, the children of the kingdom. The tares are the children of the wicked one. The enemy is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age. The reapers are the angels. When you have all that kind of information, then okay, then you understand what it is, right? Because the parables, unlike what most people would, particularly the modernists would say, they weren't meant to reveal truth. They were meant to conceal truth from those who wasn't for, and he only expounded it to those for whom it was for, okay? Those that were his disciples and would one day be sitting on those 12 thrones, right, judging the 12 tribes, they had to have an intelligent understanding of the kingdom they were going to rule, right? Okay. Well, basically, so one of these secrets of that kingdom is the fact that even though it starts out all well, and most of these parables, by the way, all show how the kingdom ultimately winds up in a failure, okay? And that's pretty much the burden of what these seven mysteries are in Matthew 13. But this particular one, he talks about the tares being those that were sown by the wicked one, when Satan's loosed for a season and sows these things, and it's at the end of the age, he gathers out from his kingdom, right? Well, whose kingdom? Christ's kingdom, right? This is the millennium. He's going to gather out from that kingdom, so it's after the millennium, okay? All these parables are about the kingdom of heaven, right? The kingdom is that thousand-year reign of Christ on the earth, right? And when you go down to the end of this parable, after the offending things are cast out, then he talks in verse 43, at that time, what? The righteous shall shine in whose kingdom? The kingdom of their Father. You see, the millennium kingdom is not the eternal kingdom. Ultimately, the Lord, after his kingdom has accomplished its purpose, that gets delivered up to the Father. Right? Come over to 1 Corinthians 15 so you can see that. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 24 through 28. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 24 through 28. Someone want to read that? Chapter 15, verses 24 through 28.
Then cometh the end, when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power. For he must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. For he hath put all things under his feet. But when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifest that he is accepted, which did put all things under him. And when all things shall be subdued unto him, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all.
Yeah. You see, sometimes when you look at all these pronouns, he, him, or who's the he and who's the him, We'll read this passage again, and this time we'll actually put in the nouns instead of the pronouns so that you can see it. He says, then cometh the end being the last one. It's the last resurrection, in other words. Okay, that's the word teleos means the last one. Okay? And when Christ shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father, when Christ shall have put down all rule and all authority and power, for Christ must reign till the Father has put all enemies under Christ's feet, the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. For the Father who hath put all things under Christ's feet, but when the Father says all things are put under Christ, it is evident or manifest that the Father is accepted, which did put all things under Christ. And when all things shall be subdued under Christ, then shall the Son also himself be subject unto the Father that put all things under him, that God the Father may be all in all. You see that? Ultimately, the Father is the one who reigns for all eternity, okay? And the Son and that kingdom is going to be the final proving ground of man. At the end of that kingdom, the final harvest of the redeemed will be gathered, right? And then it gets delivered up to the Father. It's all perfected, and you're into eternity at that point, okay? And so, again, the Feast of Tabernacles, again, the last agricultural feast in Israel's calendar pictures that final harvest of the redeemed at the end of his kingdom. Okay? And so there we have the historical context and also kind of a lead into what we'll take a look at next week when we actually look at the prophetic fulfillment and take a look at that kingdom and see what it's like. So on that note, I guess we'll leave it for next week.